Hello, listeners. I'd like to welcome to the show Tony Sobrato. Tony is a research analyst and social scientist currently based in London, author of the soon-to-be-published book, Who Rules the World? An Analysis of Conspiracy Theory. He also contributes to the Huffington Post. Hello, Tony. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Don. It's a pleasure to be here. Hello, everyone listening in Vancouver and Canada.
You come to us today to help solve some of the greatest mysteries of humanity. Why are we attracted to conspiracy theories? Are they all the same? And how do we analyze them? I guess my first question to you is going to be, are we as a species predisposed, at least socially, to see conspiracies around every corner?
Well, this is an interesting question. I mean, it depends primarily on basic human cognition, and this is in terms of observing social and natural phenomena. So the human mind is predisposed to observe phenomena, and that means we need to explain them in some form or another. Now, historically and technologically over history, we've seen these forms of social natural explanations evolve in themselves. So in antiquity, it was usually done by mythological explanation and theological explanations. And obviously, we've got the ancient classic societies that used to espouse a number of different gods that all were using the explanation of both social and natural events. So obviously, we've got the god of war, the god of love, and the god of nature. We also saw this explanation in primitive tribal societies that espouse more supernatural elements. So disease, illness, death, and social retribution was often explained by the supernatural powers of invisible agents, such as witches, evil, and satanic forces. Now, what you have to understand here is without the introduction of the scientific method, which is basically proposing a theory and then testifying it with some method, it's not hard to see how in old tribal communities, mishaps and misfortunes would have been explained by some form of agency, either within your tribe or your group, or an external agent. So, for example, something bad happens to you, a loved one may have died, so you don't know if they've died of disease, you don't know if they've been murdered. Obviously, in primal tribes, there is no forensic evidence being investigated here. So what humans primarily do, and research in neuroscience shows this, that we need agency as a form for explanation. So here we have the first premise, the interception, if you will, the introduction of an agent that is responsible for some sort of a social phenomenon. So conspiratorially, it could have been that these people got together and killed my child. That's one agent form of it. Or another agent form of explanation would be it was a supernatural element, that it was a witch or some evil force explained. So in terms of pure cognition, I think using conspiracy theories, although certain conspiracy theories do exist, and I'll talk about this later, there is a predisposed schema, a resonance, if you like, of a tribal tribe that we still need some form of conspiracy theories to explain social phenomena without, obviously, in its context, there was no complex forms of social understanding or no theoretical laws of physics to explain natural events, and obviously no social sciences yet to explain complex interaction. So conspiracy theories are cognitively embedded as a way to explain phenomena, and unfortunately people still employ them to this day.
An evolutionary psychologist might contend that a predilection to see conspiracies could be an evolutionary advantage. I mean, if I perceive a plot or conspiracy to attack my clan or village by supposed hostile enemies, there are three possible outcomes. One, I prepare a defense, but there's no attack, so I am out some resources, but I'm prepared for a potential future attack. Two, I prepare a defense, and there is an attack, but damage to my people has been minimized. Or three, I don't prepare a defense, and there's an attack, my whole clan or village is wiped out, disaster. It would seem those who are prone to see threats, real or otherwise, would have this evolutionary advantage, at least for primitive cultures and when they're not supernatural threats. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, that's completely true, and it depends how you divide conspiracy theories. And these are why they're used in primitive and modern days of social explanation, because primarily, which I'll discuss, single-point conspiracy theories do exist, which is a collection of human agents come together by certain means with certain goals and agendas to basically overcome you or a group in a certain way. So as you're saying there, with pre-tribal warfare, it is possible, and a realistic explanation could be, that another group is trying to usurp your group for whatever reason, resources, food, or land. That's where conspiracy theories, A, are useful and to a certain extent can be true. That's one reason why they've lasted so long through human evolution, because in terms of explanation, sometimes they can be correct. On the other side, in terms of mystique not having acquired knowledge and ignorance, they're unfortunately still used to explain all kinds of different social phenomena when we don't really need them anymore to be useful in explanations. And obviously, for example, we no longer use supernatural agents to explain why someone's ill, and we no longer use supernatural agents to explain phenomena in nature such as waterfalls, natural disasters. But as you say in there, one reason why conspiracy theories still have such salience today is because they are, at times, valid forms of explanations.
Probably weren't aware of this, but my last interview was with Liu Yingwei, and we were talking about witch hunters in Africa, where they were literally putting supernatural agencies behind deaths and all that sort of thing. So sadly, there are still parts of the world where that is happening. It's quite interesting. On the show, when we approach conspiracy theories, we tend to sort of have a two-part process. One, do the facts on the ground support the claim? And two, if they do, does this actually imply the conspiracy claimed? Often we find that the facts are outright falsehoods or contorted interpretations. However, some do seem to point to a smoking gun, sort of. However, most of those fail to be the big conspiracy sort of thing. You know, in an Occam razor way, you can usually find some other explanation. Most often, I tend to find they are what I call natural faux-spiracies. That is, it's not really a conspiracy, it's just the way nature sort of works. Like in capitalism, you know, the fact that corporations will all tend to want to control the price and raise the price isn't necessarily some huge plot, it's just in their nature to do in a too-free market sort of capitalist society. However, from what I read about your approach, our sort of one-size-fits-all style may not be that appropriate. From what I understand, if we are to truly understand conspiracies, we need to have sort of a theory, a framework onto which to place it. Tell us about your project. Well, why did you do it in the first place?
I read social science, or mainly political science and aspects of social psychology as an undergraduate, so I've always been interested in a certain political phenomena, and then following my master's degree, I was also interested in conspiracy theories, and this is a few years after 9/11. So it's kind of a passionate understanding of politics and current affairs, but also kind of understanding what it is about conspiracy theories and why they have such a massive appeal in the modern world. And as a child growing up, as we can all relate to, obviously, the big JFK conspiracy theories, there's the conspiracy theories about Pearl Harbor and the Second World War, there's conspiracy theories about whether Hitler died or not. And this was kind of brought to fruition with the massive show in the 90s, The X-Files, where kind of conspiracy theories went mainstream. So from my perspective, obviously, it's kind of a mixture of academia and general interest. And what I've been doing with my research is breaking down the different types of conspiracy theories. And one reason why one size fits all is not a very good way to understand conspiracy theories in terms of both the people that espouse them and people like us that try to investigate and understand them is that they're so complex in terms of what they're trying to kind of advocate that you have to break them down differently to see which kind of conspiracy theories are plausible and then distinguish them from the ones that aren't plausible. Now, this applies to certain phenomena, say you say 9/11, which is basically you can take any kind of evidence and facts and then twist them in a way that makes it look logical and plausible. This can happen to any discourse and any phenomenon, and everyone does it in social explanations. Now, what I advocate with single-point conspiracy theories, and that's kind of alluding to the point that you were making with tribal warfare and explaining warfare as the consequences of agents wanting to usurp people. This is a single point of conspiracy theory in terms of it's independent to its own social and historical context. And these are the kind of conspiracy theories that are plausible and are potentially true. Another perfect example of this is obviously Julius Caesar, who was actually murdered by a single point conspiracy, the famous Brutus incident. So he was brought down by people that no longer wanted him in the Senate. Now, these are single point conspiracy theories that, if they occur, they are independent to their social and historical context and nothing else. For example, if you're an advocate of the JFK conspiracy theory, then the most plausible explanation behind that in terms of a single point conspiracy theory is that it was other agents, apart from Lee Harvey Oswald, whether it was the Cuban Castro affiliations or the mafia, that were involved in assassinating the president. Nothing more. Okay, it's a form of vile corruption, but it could happen as a single point of conspiracy theory. What this then entails is then when these kind of single point conspiracy theories become embellished and elaborated to what we call meta conspiracy theories, which are that the conspiracy theory, the incident or the phenomena observed, is tied into a grander and overarching conspiracy theory. And this is really causes problems for the people that advocate them, because off the bat they sound completely irrational and like lunatics, when really what they should be doing with a conspiracy theory is focusing on one conspiracy theory and not how it's overarched to a meta conspiracy theory. So prime examples of this are, say, JFK, 9/11, the murder of John Paul II. They're all operated by the same shadowy cabal, such as the Illuminati or the New World Order, for reasons to take over the world. Now, these are the kind of meta-conspiracy theories that are less plausible. Now, what happens with these conspiracy theories over single-point conspiracy theories, which are plausible, is that they become evolved and embellished in themselves. And what happens is, where it's hard to basically justify such complex social phenomena in terms of it's all being coming back to a single source, like a secret society that's basically running history behind a closed door over, say, hundreds and possibly thousands of years, that everything's kind of intricately linked like a pattern, where these kind of explanations start to sound bizarre in themselves in terms of social phenomena, these conspiracy theories evolve into transcendental and metaphysical conspiracy theories, because you now have to leave the realm of everyday social natural explanation and you have to propose other agencies or form of agencies that are responsible for this. And this is where we see the classic case of someone like David Icke, which is no longer operating in the social world. He's dealing with shape-shifting aliens, forms of higher consciousness that are responsible for this grand historical conspiracy theory, or also conservative right-wing conspiracy theories which believe it's all the work of the devil. And these kind of conspiracy theories have to leave the social realm, because if they're going to explain historically over hundreds and possibly thousands of years how each incident in history is controlled by one agency or force, then it's not likely in terms of everyday social explanation that it's going to be one group. It has to be a more powerful group. And thus we see such agencies as shape-shifting aliens or the devil coming into the picture. So this is kind of the issue that makes conspiracy theories more complex, because when you study a conspiracy theory, you have to see whether it's a single point of conspiracy theory or a meta conspiracy theory. And this is kind of the work I've been doing in terms of basically breaking down different types of conspiracy theory and seeing where their complexities arise. If I may also just make a point here as well, which is to do with terminology. Now, I agree with you completely in terms of saying that corporations that maximise profit under a capitalist paradigm has nothing to do with a conspiracy theory, and I agree with that. That's just one way of looking at the social world. So a meta-conspiracy theorist, someone like, say, Alex Jones or David Icke, would propose that it's all kind of part of the bigger plan, a bigger picture, whether it's the Illuminati or the New World Order. Then you could have a Marxist argument saying that, no, this has nothing to do with a meta-conspiracy theory. It's just how the economic base constantly determines social and political activity. And that's one way of looking at the free market economics and corporations. Another way you can analyze it is by, instead of looking at constant conspiracies used in explanation, you can look at terms of corruption and unaccountable democratic electability. So one work that I've been doing recently with Dr. Ian Mitchison, who's the author of the Bilderberg Group Elite Consensus, is a very interesting area, because we look at the Bilderberg Group not in terms of it's basically a collection of the world's most rich and powerful people behind a closed door making decisions about how they're going to control the world. It's more to do with issues of unelectable accountability, because these people sit outside governments and basically make decisions that affect the world. And now this can be explained in terms of elite theory and social science. At the same time, conspiracy theories kind of get shoehorned in through the back door and are like, well, this is part of a meta-conspiracy theory to rule the world. So this is the kind of the complexity you're dealing with when you're looking at these phenomena and how conspiracy theories are used to explain them. And that's really why I've been breaking down the model in terms of single-point conspiracy theories, meta-conspiracy theories, and also using the social sciences to explain conspiracy theories.
Okay, we're going to take a bit of a break. When we come back, we'll continue our interview with Tony Sobrato. Welcome back. So, Tony, one thing I've noticed in what we were discussing before the break is people didn't have a fuzzy idea about what qualifies as a conspiracy. How would you define a conspiracy in the context of your framework?
Well, if you look at the standard definition of conspiracy, it's an act between more than one agent to elicit some kind of response in a social phenomena, usually hidden, so it's outside of public view. That's kind of a loose understanding of conspiracy. And conspiracies do happen, as we know. I mean, they happen in social situations. I mean, just as a trivial point, you could be going out somewhere with your friends tonight and you've got one club that you want to go to, or one bar, or one theatre, and everyone's agreed to do that. And then you turn up and you find out that that theatre or that club or that bar apparently isn't showing the show that you wanted to watch. Then you later find out that two of your friends only said that to you because they wanted to go to another theatre. Technically, in social terms and linguistic terms, they have conspired against you. But that is not the same as a meta-conspiracy theory or political conspiracy theory, which basically states straight off the bat that what you perceive as social, political, and economic reality is merely an illusion, and what agents are behind this phenomena aren't visible. That's what qualifies a conspiracy theory in this context.
You've talked about the connection between postmodernist thinking and conspiracy theorist mind, in particular deconstructionist theory, that in a world that seems to make little sense to these people, there is a rejection of all the, quote, established truth, thus allowing them, subconsciously I'm sure, to interpret data, and I use data here because facts for them don't really have the same meaning it would for you and I, but allows them to interpret the data to support some overarching conspiracy that will explain sort of the dystopian state of the world that they perceive. Is my explanation right? How does this gain us insight into the theorist's mind, and what does it say about the validity of their claims?
That's a very interesting point. In terms of, I look at conspiracy theories also in terms of philosophy of science and philosophy of social science, so it's the use and validity of facts. Now, this ties in two ways. In terms of the postmodern tradition, there is no such thing as universal or external truth. Everything is up for grabs under a discourse. Now, if you look at the famous philosopher Jacques Derrida and deconstruction theory, which is any phenomena is open to unlimited forms of interpretation. And we see this happen all the time, every day, under any phenomenon. So if you think about the origin and the present state of the universe, there are basically more or less in a crude way of breaking this form down, there are two alternative views to this. One is that it's so improbable that all the laws of physics came together to make a hospitable cosmos and make life on Earth, yet so improbable, yet it's possible, and we're here by pure chance. Now, there's another school of thought that looks at that exact same evidence and the exact same facts and say that, no, this can't be chance, there must be a grand design behind this. And if you take this applied to postmodernism, which is basically that any phenomena is up for interpretation and up for any kind of grabs, then you have discourses formed. Now, discourses form objects of which they speak, as Michel Foucault once said. So what you have here is you have a discourse of conspiracy theory. And what's interesting about these discourses, and hence the whole postmodern tradition, is that truth and reality aren't outside these discourses. They become formed in the discourses themselves. So this applies again to a wide-ranging phenomena. The word particle in quantum mechanics or quantum physics can be empirically measured, but the word particle doesn't exist outside of the discourse of physics itself. It can be empirically measured, but without being in the discourse of physics itself, no one would know what a particle is. So in that respect, the discourse forms truth and reality in one respect, even though it can be empirically measured, and this is what sets it apart from conspiracy theories. At the same time, however, conspiracy theories have their own established forms of truth present within these discourses, and these are usually tenets and principles such as 9/11, look at this phenomenon, okay, the towers were brought down, why was that? Oh, it was because it was an inside job by the US government, it was a false flag operation. How do you know this? Oh, we've got this evidence that points to this. What evidence is this? That basically the day before the US government knew and they didn't do anything about it. Oh, okay. So that comes into the discourse of conspiracy theory. And at the same time, whilst it's doing this, it's perpetuating its own truth and reality. So conspiracy theories, in terms of social truth, become created in their own discourse. And this is what you see happens between conspiracy theories and people that challenge them, like you and I, is that we're not part of that discourse game. We're outside the discourse. We're the people that try to debunk their discourse. As we're in their discourse, obviously, they're suspicious of us because in that discourse, they've got the truth and the reality down, which is that 9/11 or JFK was an inside job, and it is basically that's the conspiracy theory formed the truth in itself. So that's one essence of how postmodernism, in terms of the creation of truth, reality within a discourse and using evidence and facts to propose an argument, has a massive influence on conspiracy theory. Also, in terms of facts, what you were saying there, I think they kind of have the same understanding of facts as you and I and every other person, but it's just articulated in a more haphazard and unsystematic way, because if you look at the anomalies behind 9/11, they point to all different kinds of facts, such as, like I said, the US government apparently had a warning behind the day before, or why was it that no one was in Tower 7 doing operation checks in terms of sniffer dogs and bombs. These are kind of facts that that can actually be validated. There were no sniffer dogs the week before doing checks on bombs in the building, which is just routine mishap and misfortune. But these kind of anomalies kind of get blown up into kind of conspiratorial explanations. So they do use facts like any other rational thinking person. It's just that they pick and choose what facts they use, and they manipulate them in a different way. And this is one area that's also got in prominent research later, which is rationality and conspiracy theories. And there's a great professor of philosophy in Australia called David Cody, who's been doing work on this, and he's basically been presenting the idea that conspiracy theories are rational, but only inside the discourse of conspiracy theory themselves. And this kind of points to what I'm saying with postmodernism, which is if you're in a discourse of conspiracy theory, you're using the same facts as I am, but we're coming to different conclusions. And to that schema and that state, it makes sense. But outside that discourse, it doesn't make sense. So the issue here is more to do, to a certain extent, it's obviously postmodernism, which anything's up for grabs, but also to do with the psychology and the schema and the worldview. Because if you're a conspiracy theorist, then you're more likely to understand other events as conspiracy theories, and that's a topic I can talk on a bit later.
Actually, so in that one area, and maybe I used the wrong word with respect, but one of the things that seems to be quite common is, and again, perhaps I'm being a bit full of myself here in saying it this way, but we often say our opinions are based upon facts, that we have the facts, and from that we derive our opinions. And it seems to be almost the reverse for conspiracy. They have their opinions, and onto that, they find the facts. It's almost a reversal of the causal chain.
That's one aspect of it. But at the same time, if you look at what they do with facts, it's everyone starts off with some form of social observation, and then we come to a conclusion either way. I'm not necessarily advocating that they start with an opinion and then end up at the facts, which sometimes they do, which is the scheme of conspiracy theory, which I'll talk about a bit later, which is basically if you're predisposed to see the world like this, then you're going to have an opinion first and let the facts flourish. But at the same time, they can start in the opposite direction, which is observing a fact and then coming up to a different conclusion. So if you think about 9/11, one fact is that basically after the first plane went in the building, it took air traffic control, I believe, about an hour or two to scramble fighter planes. And unfortunately, they sent a few of them in the wrong direction because the radar on the plane that went in to the building obviously turned off the radar. And the other plane that had been hijacked, they had turned off the sonar radar and that signal. So literally, air traffic control couldn't find this plane. That's actually a fact. Now, what you do with that fact after is up to you, and that becomes part of the discourse game. Now, I personally believe, as most people probably would, that this is just a genuine mistake there, and it's easy to understand why they couldn't find the plane, because the terrorists had turned off the sonar in there, so it's hard to find a plane. Now, if you're a conspiracy theorist, you take that same fact, and it's part of a meta-overarching explanation where, in this world, coincidence and mishaps and accidents don't happen. There is some form of agency out there that's responsible for this. So they take the same fact that we couldn't find these planes on this certain day, and they come to the conclusion that it was deliberately executed to be this way. So it depends on how you take facts and how you use them to come to a conclusion. And to a certain extent, they do use, I believe, the same facts as us, just come to a different convoluted conclusion and explanation.
Thank you, Tony, for your time. Listeners, we will continue this interview next week when Tony will once again be here in our virtual studio. We will discuss conspiracy theory as political ideology. But now,